It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Fall is here, winter is coming, and the flu season is upon us. Health officials are warning people to get their flu shots. Have you gotten yours yet? Are you not going to? If not, why not? Last year's flu season was pretty brutal, and this year's flu outlook is just as serious. My guest is Dr. James Conway, Associate Director of Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Conway is a pediatric disease specialist. Dr. Conway, good morning. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, last year, 379 people in Wisconsin died from the flu. Just over 7,500 people were hospitalized. Are these numbers typical, or was last year a particularly bad year?
Last year was a somewhat worse year than usual, although we've had some of these kinds of years now intermittently over the last 12 or 15 years.
So why do we see these yearly fluctuations?
Well, flu is one of these diseases where it's actually a collection of viruses. They mutate constantly throughout the season, and they obviously circulate worldwide. And as they recombine with other flu viruses from other animal species, we get emergence of new strains and variations of strains. And so we get new strains that then get introduced into the population, and if people don't have much immunity, then we have worse seasons than usual.
So what's being done by public health officials and others to prevent the high number of hospitalizations and deaths this year?
Well, obviously, our primary protection is going to be with vaccination, and we continue to try to get more and more people immunized. You know, we've gradually expanded our recommendations. Initially, it was obviously older individuals and then children, but we've really gotten to the point where we recognize that flu is so unpredictable, and though we thought that we would primarily focus on high-risk individuals, we realize it can attack anybody. And so the recommendations now are that everybody from 6 months up until death basically get influenza vaccine.
So do we have any idea of what the flu is going to look like this season, symptoms? What do we know about the most recent mutation of the flu virus?
Well, it's always a bit of a guessing game. You know, the WHO and CDC and other organizations have to make a good guess way back in January, February about what strains are actually going to show up in the fall. And that's what is then directed to the vaccine manufacturers for their vaccine production. And we're looking at this point at probably a moderate season compared to previous seasons. It's been a relatively rough season in the southern hemisphere where they're just wrapping up winter. And so we use that as a predictor for what will come in the future here. And so the vaccine this year has a number of new viruses that have been modified to hopefully improve the protection for the vaccine this coming year.
And just so we're clear, I mean, we're not saying that if you get a vaccination that you are 100% guaranteed not to get the flu, because you mentioned all the mutations that can happen, but you're less likely to get it by quite a bit if you have a vaccination. Would that be correct?
That's correct. And actually, one of the things that people really need to understand is that even with an imperfect product like the influenza vaccine and the moving target of the flu virus itself, the goal is not to prevent every case of the disease. The goal is actually to prevent anybody who gets the disease from getting any severity to that disease. So, you know, when people look at these reports in the media, with all due respect, the media likes bad news sometimes, that they report these low efficacy rates of, you know, 30 or 40% protection. That's in an absolute black and white world where you're saying it either protects or doesn't. What we really look at is, does it protect you from getting severely ill and getting hospitalized? And that's where we see, even in a bad year where the vaccine doesn't match perfectly to the viruses, that it's still 80 or 90% of people are going to be protected. That's the goal that we really need to keep in mind.
Do we know that we have enough flu vaccine so that everybody can get a shot, or are we going to be short?
Well, the production looks like it's going well this year. However, you know, since we know that a lot of people don't bother to go get themselves immunized, there is technically not enough vaccine to give to every American. And so we do, unfortunately, sort of depend on the fact that some people just choose not to get the vaccine. With that said, you know, if even twice as many people as usually get the vaccine wanted the vaccine, we probably could accommodate them.
Dr. James Conway is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also a pediatric disease specialist. Have you gotten your flu shot yet? Are you going to? If not, I'd like to know why you decided not to. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. 800-642-1234. We continue this conversation ahead. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, the flu season is just about here. Time to get a flu shot. In fact, while we were on that break, I scheduled my flu shot appointment. So, yay me, right? Dr. James Conway, the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is my guest. He's here to talk about how to protect yourself and your family this flu season. We have a caller on the line. Let's take a call right now from Justin, who is joining us from Appleton. Justin, good morning. Thanks for being here today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Here, I just had a little comment. I've heard that, you know, there's not always the best choice to go with a flu shot because for a few reasons. You might want to let your immune system build up a resistance to the flu shot because there's more than one flu strain, as we all know. And I think that we could benefit from allowing our immune systems to grow. And there's a lot of ways to do that. But maybe the flu shots aren't the best route because there's another thing. There might be some negative side effects from some of the ingredients in there, specifically the preservatives. So maybe we could have the expert talk about that a little bit.
All right, Dr. Conway, people are skeptical. They either think the flu shot doesn't work or that other reasons, as Justin was talking about building up his own immune system. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Thanks for calling, Justin, and appreciate your question. So this is actually an important thing to talk about because, you know, there used to be some concerns about things like mercury preservatives that were in the vaccines. Thimerosal was the vaccine preservative that was used and had been around since the 1930s. It's an inert form of mercury. But because of the concerns of people like Justin and others, there was a major initiative that started in the 1990s to actually remove those preservatives from vaccines. And so, you know, if you look carefully in the last 10 years, thimerosal and the other similar preservatives have largely been removed from all of the vaccines that are currently delivered to people in the United States. There is a little bit used in the production process to keep things sterile, but that is all removed by the end. So the concerns about the previous preservatives have really gone by the wayside. The other thing is that we have obviously decades of safety data now after, you know, hundreds of millions of doses literally have been administered. And the U.S. government and the CDC and others at the FDA keep really close tabs on side effect things because that's obviously one of the most important things. If we're giving something to healthy people to protect them, we want to make sure that we're not putting them at further risk. And so there's a really robust database and really aggressive surveillance looking for those kinds of things. So I think we can be really relatively reassured at this point that these vaccines really are quite safe and there's really very little concern about the side effects. As far as the immunity issue of letting yourself be exposed to these things, I think people need to recognize that, you know, last year 400 kids in the United States died. 80% of those were unimmunized kids. And so gambling on the fact that you may be able to fight this off and may have a robust immune system is really not worthwhile because it's such an unpredictable disease.
Some people say they felt sick after getting the vaccine, so they don't want to have it. What do you say to convince them that they need that flu shot this year?
Well, we can't dismiss the fact that it hurts and that it is intended to stimulate your immune system a little bit to try to mimic the fact that it may have actually thought it had the disease before. So I think some people do get a little bit of a revved up immune system for a few days. Usually that's maybe a little achiness, but really benign compared to the risk of actually getting real flu.
Maybe a little ibuprofen is all that's needed there then. Has the flu season already started?
Flu season has already started. We've already had our first three confirmed cases of influenza A, which is usually the more aggressive one, confirmed in Wisconsin. So, you know, flu is constantly entering the country as people come in on airplanes, and so it's not surprising. I think people have this idea that it doesn't happen during the summer. It's mostly that there just isn't as much surveillance and we aren't swabbing people and testing them. But flu is around all year, but has already showed up as confirmed cases here in Wisconsin.
So what's the best time of the year to get your flu shot?
Well, I think early and often. I think, you know, as soon as you can get yourself scheduled, as you did, I think that's the wisest thing to do. You know, although most of the season tends to peak in January, February, we've had seasons where, you know, November was pretty robust, and so it's an unpredictable situation. So flu vaccine is now becoming available throughout the state, and I would encourage people to get it in October as quickly as possible.
So you're saying early and often, should we get more than one flu shot in a season?
No, I mean, children less than 9 years of age do need two doses the first season that they get the vaccine. They get a primer and then a booster. The rest of us should just make sure we get it every year.
Okay. All right. Good to clarify that. Dr. James Conway is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the UW-Madison. Thank you for joining the show, Dr. Conway.
Thanks, John. Proud sustaining member.
Okay, good. Excellent. Like to hear that. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. White supremacy is out. White nationalist and white separatist are just fine as far as Facebook is concerned. Do you think Facebook's policy on white supremacy versus white nationalism and white separatism makes sense, or does it need to change? My guest is Jason Kebler, the editor-in-chief of Motherboard. Jason, good morning, and thank you for joining me on the morning show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Facebook's current hate speech policy allows white nationalism or white separatism, but not white supremacy. So someone could post, white nationalism is the only way. That statement would be allowed, but the statement, white supremacy is the only way, would not be allowed. How did this policy come about?
Right. So Facebook has had hate speech policies for a few years now, but this really crystallized after the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally last year. Facebook realized that it had a real problem with this, and so it looked at its policies again and had to decide where it wanted to draw the line. And this is where it decided, you know, white supremacy is not allowed, but white nationalism and white separatism are. And if you ask people who have sort of studied the history of white supremacy in the United States, they might tell you that there's not really much of a distinction between these things.
When did we find out about this Facebook policy?
Right. So Motherboard, the publication I run, has been reporting on content moderation for a few years now. And earlier this year, we got some leaked internal training documents, and its hate speech policies were part of this. So we were the first ones to report this back in May. We did a bigger feature, and I went to Facebook's headquarters to talk to them specifically about this policy and a few others back in June. So for now, this is still Facebook's internal policies, but we recently heard that it has begun to reconsider the policy.
So where does this distinction between white supremacy and white nationalism or separatism come from?
Right. So Facebook actually pulled this distinction from Wikipedia. It says that it has, you know, talked to experts in the field, but, you know, when you talk to Black history scholars or people who have studied this subject, they say that white nationalism and white separatism are movements that are sort of disguised white supremacy. It's what the KKK and David Duke and other white supremacists have called their movements to make it seem more inclusive and, I guess, less hateful.
So, I mean, this is sounds like this is a case of, you know, if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Have white supremacist groups actively promoted this distinction then on social media, saying, hey, we're not racist, we're white nationalists?
Well, there are a lot of white nationalist and white separatist groups on Facebook where they say, you know, they might have a white state or a white separatist, like that quote in the title of their group. I don't know that, I haven't seen any organizing specifically by white supremacists or white nationalist groups saying, hey, here's the distinction. You know, before we reported it, this was all internal. This was what Facebook was using to train its moderators. It has about 7,500 moderators around the world who review content. You know, not all of them focus on the United States, but, you know, Facebook keeps this stuff close to the chest so people can't actively sort of see where the lines are and then try to game the system.
Wondering what you think, listeners. Are there ways you think Facebook needs to change its hate speech policy, or do you think it's fine the way it is? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're talking with Jason Kebler, the editor and in chief of Motherboard, about this Facebook hate speech policy. Facebook has implied that if pro-white nationalist statements are considered hate speech, they might have to consider the same of other nationalist and separatist groups like Zionists and black nationalists. Once you apply a policy to one group, what does it mean for other groups then?
Right. So Facebook has decided that it wants to have one set of rules for the entire world, which is kind of how it has, in its mind, backed itself into a corner here. You know, I think Mark Zuckerberg has specifically said he doesn't, you know, condone a lot of like Holocaust denial, for instance, but believes that you should be able to say it on Facebook. And the reason for that is because Facebook has tried to make rules that cut across cultural, geographic, and political boundaries. You know, in practice, this is a much trickier thing to do. Facebook doesn't want to have to enforce one set of rules in the United States and a different set of rules elsewhere. But then when you look at how Facebook does this in practice, you see, you know, this document that we published is specific to the United States. It's not a different set of rules, but it's a different set of sort of guidelines or mechanisms for enforcing the rules. It just spells out the specifics. And then, but we do see where content is banned by a local government, Facebook will take it down. So Facebook allows Holocaust denial, but in several countries in Europe where Holocaust denial is illegal, Facebook will geo-block it. We've also seen Facebook bans content that denigrates Allah or Muslims in countries where that is banned, but will allow it elsewhere, even if it doesn't violate Facebook's policies. So it gets very tricky once you actually talk about enforcement.
Is this a simple issue of semantics? For example, if the company bans white nationalists in the United States, does that mean they have to ban black nationalists because of the name?
I mean, Facebook doesn't have to do anything. It's a private company, and it could draw different distinctions for white separatism versus black separatism. In the United States, there is a history of white nationalism and white supremacy, whereas there is not a sort of cultural and historical precedent for black separatism or black supremacy or subjugation of white people in the United States. So it's something that Facebook could do. We see here that Facebook draws a lot of very distinct lines for things like white nationalism, white separatism. If you take that and apply it to the thousands of other rules on Facebook, you know, they get very specific. Facebook bans nudity and sexual content, but it allows breastfeeding mothers. It allows, you know, nipples in the case of like art. And it's just, you apply this similar worldview to thousands of different rules, and it becomes a very complex thing to enforce.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at it kind of from their point of view on a technical basis, this is pretty much an impossible thing to manage, because if they have to choose to ban all hate speech, which would censor some groups, or allow some hate speech while giving more groups and people a platform, it seems like it would be it's a nearly impossible task, don't you think?
Right. I mean, that's actually the headline of our big feature we ran about this problem. I think we call it the impossible task. And it really is one of the most difficult logistical problems Silicon Valley has ever faced. Facebook has over 2 billion users in more than 100 countries. They speak, you know, dozens of languages. And for, you know, you talk about white supremacy or white nationalism in the context of the United States. This is a country that Facebook was founded in. Facebook is headquartered here. Facebook should know sort of the cultural implications of white supremacy and white nationalism in the United States. But then you think about, you know, countries in where Facebook doesn't have a lot of cultural background or a lot of employees or a lot of history. They all have their own histories. They all have their own, you know, interactions between people, their own hate speech. You look at what has happened in Myanmar, where Facebook has been accused of helping to facilitate genocide with fake news and hate speech there. And it is a really, really tough thing. Facebook tries to have an over 99% accuracy rating by its own metrics on this stuff. But even at that accuracy rating, it has, you know, millions and millions of reports every day. So that's, you know, hundreds of thousands of mistakes every week. And once you look at it that way, it's really, I mean, it's impossible to even think about.
Do you think that it's likely that Facebook will change this policy that we've been talking about? And if so, what would that look like?
Yeah, so there has been a lot of outrage from civil rights groups, civil rights lawyers about this specific policy. I don't know if Facebook will change it. It has remained pretty steadfast that this is where the line is. Facebook isn't too worried about sticking by where it has drawn the line, but I think you brought up a good point. You know, Facebook has to draw the line somewhere, and the fact is there are white nationalists and white separatists and white supremacists on Facebook, and if it draws the line in a way that is too, I guess, overcorrects possibly, you know, Facebook runs the risk of angering people on that side, people who use the platform. And so Facebook wants to appeal to everyone. It's said that it's a platform for everyone. And so, you know, if they draw the line in a way that people feel discriminated against in one way or the other, they could stand to lose those customers. I'm not saying that's the right thing to do, but I think that's how Facebook looks at this.
Well, and at the end of the day, as you point out, Facebook is a private company and they can kind of do whatever they want, although they, you know, they have to consider the market. So it's kind of a delicate balancing act. So what do you think the consequences are in the meantime of continuing to allow pro-white nationalist and pro-white separatist speech on the site?
Right. I mean, we saw last year with the Charlottesville rally, a lot of that was organized on Facebook. We have heard, you know, harassment, bullying, racism, misogyny on Facebook and other social media. It does have psychological impacts on the people who have to see that. It has impacts on the people, you know, when they organize in real life. And so it does have an impact. And I think Facebook doesn't really know the full extent of that on an individual basis.
All right, Jason Kebler, Editor-in-Chief of Motherboard, thank you for joining the show this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson.